Hello everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host. I'm recording on Saturday the 16th of March 2024, out in Reykjavik, Iceland as always. And I was just going to move straight onto the games there, but I realised that twice in the last couple of weeks I've heard friends who have podcasts doing light, gentle satire of the opening of Gaming in the Wild, where I always tell you about the weather. So looking out of the window right now, just so as not to let anyone down. It is cloudy, it's kind of dusty out there, it's a bit weird. We've got this strange autumny weather right now. But spring is coming, and I'm looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to it a little more this week than before. And that's because I got approved for a pass to go to a little games event in London next month called WASD. It is the first time that I will have been to one of these kind of things, and it seems like an event with two strands to it. There is a show floor where people will be showing new indie games that they are working on. You can walk the floor, play the games, talk to the developers, that kind of thing. And it also seems to have like a professional element to it, where games makers and publicists and publishers and the business side of everything will rock up and maybe talk and chat and have events and to give talks and that sort of thing. So I'm excited to be going there. I will be going with Kieran. It was actually his idea. You might know Kieran as a sometime guest of the show, especially around Games of the Year time. So I'll be hanging out with Kieran there. So if any of you fine listeners are going to WASD in April, keep an eye out for me. If you see someone that looks like me at WASD, it probably is me. But outside of the coming of spring and the WASD news, there's a lot to talk about on this episode. I've played a few games. I played a Tron-inspired Bullet Heaven game called Geometry Survivor. I played a cute cabin builder that I've talked about before called Summer House, which finally came out on Steam. I also polished off Intergrade, so the intermission part, the DLC that came with Final Fantasy Remake. And I started Rebirth. So four games to talk about. And I am looking forward to talking about all of them. But before we get there, a little bit of housekeeping as well. There are a few games that have been added to the podcast slate this week. There are five, no less, so let's rattle through them. The first one's a co-op game called Enshrouded. And if you know what this game is, you might be raising an eyebrow right now, but I know it's not my usual kind of thing. It's a co-op survival RPG kind of game, but I've heard some really good things about it from people whose taste I align with a lot of the time. So I reached out and got a couple codes for that one with the theory that Kieran and I could hop on and play it together. I've downloaded it to my ROG Ally. He has downloaded it to his PC. And so we are just waiting for the stars to align and hopefully we can hop on and see what all the fuss is about when it comes to Enshrouded. And the next game is another one that's not usually in my genre wheelhouse. It's Solium Infernum. This is a turn-based strategy game set in hell. There are some politics to it, there are some battling to it, an intrigue to it. And I was fully intending to pass this one over, but then I saw an Accolades trailer that came in very, very hot. It has a Metacritic 85, and it seems to be the talk of the town with fans of the genre. I popped online and watched Day 9 streaming a little bit of it on YouTube, and it looks like a really fun time. So I'm popping that one on the slate as well, and hopefully I'll get to it in the next month or so. I've also been playing a little bit of Snufkin Melody of Moomin Valley. A code came through for that one. I've been playing it very, very slowly, like half an hour at a time, and just loving life in that game, honestly. It's heavily recommended for those of you who play it alongside kids or want something really lovely and undemanding and relaxing to unwind your mind with. Or if, like me, you just love Moomins, it's great for all of those things. So I'll be reviewing that one in the future as well. A code came in for Pepper Grinder as well. It's nice to see codes come out early sometimes. Sometimes when codes come very, very late or even after release, you get a feeling that the team is scrambling to finish the game, basically. But sometimes a game will just pop out like 2, 3, 4 weeks before release. It kind of fills you with a little bit of confidence. You feel that the game is ready and done and dusted, and they are happy for journalists to see it. So always a good sign to get early codes, and Pepper Grinder is with me now, and I'll be playing that one before release. I think the embargo lifts on the 28th of this month when the game comes out. Finally, a game that a lot less people are talking about, but that I thought looked quite interesting and fun, Floramancer, Seeds and Spells. It's a top-down game with pixel art. There is a bit of farming where you grow plants to make spells. You can then use your spells in a twin-stick shooter kind of way. So it's a little bit of farming, a little bit of pixel RPG, a little bit of twin-stick shooter. I was intrigued enough to pick up a code for that one too, so that is downloaded and ready to go. And I will be trying out Floramancer, Seeds and Spells over the next couple of weeks too. And a big thank you to all of those publishers and publicists for reaching out about games or sending over review copies. I really, really appreciate it. I have also been continuing to make YouTube videos, so if you like this podcast and want more of this kind of thing, I've been posting one every couple days over on the YouTube channel at youtube.com/gamingintheWild. I published a game about four indie games that I consider to have intriguing, fascinating, deep stories. I did one about four open world indie games that you can play in a day for people that have got open world fatigue, that difficult condition that we all struggle with from time to time. But it's been really fun making the videos. Honestly, it's a different way of talking about games. I think in YouTube, you have to be a lot more concise. You have to keep the tempo up, which is something that you probably know it doesn't come naturally to me if you're listening to this show. So it's a different challenge, and also like formulating ways to talk about games, like what's an interesting angle that will allow you to talk about a few games that will bring people into a video. It's actually a very fun challenge, and I've really been enjoying doing it. So if you'd like to see the results, pop over to YouTube and search Gaming in the Wild, or check out the link in the description. And the last bit of housekeeping before we get to the games is to thank the show's latest patrons. We've had an influx lately, so thanks very much to Lisa, thanks very much to Kira, and thanks very much to Stu, the latest patron, who sent me a really lovely message all the way from Yokohama and found the podcast through YouTube and then has been listening to it and had some thoughts. So thanks, Stu, for the message, and thanks for becoming a patron. You, listener, are, of course, welcome to join them in supporting this podcast at patreon.com/gamingintheWild. There are loads of perks, including an invite to the Discord server, which is a wonderful corner of the internet. I can't recommend it highly enough. You'll get 10 bonus episodes. I think there might be more than 10 now, and I have a few more in the pipes. And you get a whole bunch of other perks too. It's $1 a month or more if you like, and that is at patreon.com/gamingintheWild. And thanks very much to all my existing patrons, and thank you very much to you if that's something that you would consider. And with all of that said, let's get on with it and talk about the games. I'm going to start by talking about Final Fantasy VII Remake Intermission, and of course the game of the moment everyone's talking about, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. So I shared my thoughts about Final Fantasy Remake with you last week, but this week I played Intermission, which is the DLC that came out. It's like a mini episode that popped out between Remake and Rebirth, and I have nothing but praise for that DLC. It was so nice. You play as Yuffie. She is a little girlish ninja slash spy. She's a very fun, likable, anime-ass character. He spends half the game dressed as a Moogle for some reason, but she felt great to play as. Yuffie was quite a contrast to Cloud Strife, the protagonist of Final Fantasy VII. She was fast and nimble. She played differently. She felt different. She was light on her feet. She had wall running, so you were zipping around these factories, turning panels around to wall run across and collect potions and chests and all of that kind of thing. She had a new combat style as well. She uses a giant shuriken or a boomerang or a ranged weapon of some kind, and she can throw it to break boxes. There are boxes everywhere that you cannot get to on foot, so you have to do that. Fun little gameplay thing, man. Isn't it just fun? It's like in Zelda when you walk around cutting bushes and you're just having a whale of a time doing the most absolutely simple thing. It felt a little bit like that in Intermission, like breaking boxes and spotting them on higher shelves as Yuffie. It was just a lot of fun from moment to moment. But her combat moveset is really different to Cloud as well. You can charge in and strike quickly. You can hit with the boomerang and then jump off an enemy to get distance and then throw at them. But best of all, they introduced synergies. These are synchronized special moves. Yuffie is with a fellow Wutaian spy called Sonon, and you can work together to do these cinematic cool moves. Another thing that I liked about it is I love a good in-game game. I've been trying to think about what we call these, you know, like Gwent. What do we call an in-game game? Is there a clever, fancy term for that, like a Ludo or something? Because I feel like there should be. If you do know what that is, then let me know. But Intermission had a great one. It's called Fort Condor. It's a simple tower defense RTS. You and your opponent face off across a board. You each have three towers at your side that you have to defend, and you do this by dropping in automated units that then go to work basically and do their own thing. There are ranged ones, grenade ones, flying ones, heavy artillery, slow tanks, units that produce more units, hounds, and they all have different strengths and weaknesses that make them better or worse for certain things. And as you advance across the map, you take territory, and any territory that is yours, you can drop more units into. So if you have one very advanced unit attacking the enemy castle, you can drop in more there. But if they are taken out, your territory will come right back to your castles, and you have to go right across the board again. It reminded me a little bit of the Star Wars Holo Chess game that we got in Jedi Survivor, although that remains my favourite in-game game. I'm not quite sure why. That might be a fun little video idea, actually. The best in-game games. And Fort Condor would make the list. But Intermission itself is also a good game. I really enjoyed the story. It is a self-contained episode, but it has little bits of overlap with the events of the main game. It fleshes out some of the villains. It gives you an insight into the people of Midgar that exist around Avalanche, that central group of the main game. It starts when Yuffie arrives in the city. She is a Wutai spy sent to steal some materia. On the way, she passes through Sector 7. She connects with Avalanche, infiltrates the Shinra HQ, and then tries to get into the R&D development of Shinra Tower, and that's where most of the game takes place. There are some cool combat gauntlets, there are some light puzzling that uses that wall running that I talked about, and it leads up to a brilliant boss fight, a really tortured, spectral boss fight with a character I'd forgotten about from the original game, but was very happy to see here. It's only two chapters long, it takes about 4 or 5 hours to complete, but this was the best part of the Final Fantasy VII Remake project so far for me. It's DLC, and so it's by nature very lean. It is mostly killer and little filler, which I really appreciated, especially compared to that first game. It had a big visual glow-up that was really noticeable, really high resolution, crisp, sharp, and nicely lit. It just looked great throughout, and it felt like a lot of the kinks of Remake had been ironed out. It was a smoother play all round, so top marks for Intermission. It got me very much hyped for Rebirth. And so as soon as I finished Intermission, I took a little break and then dived right in. Rebirth is, of course, the second of three games in this epic remake of Final Fantasy VII. I've played 5 hours of Rebirth so far, which includes a really cool flashback sequence that is from the original game, the first town of Calm in the present day, and then a glimpse of the first open world section. So I've played a chunk of game at this point. And the flashback sequence, the opening, was really, really fun. It's a great place to pick up the story. It had some iconic moments in it that everyone who has played Final Fantasy VII, or even knows of the game, are probably aware of. It's Cloud retelling his prior experience of Sephiroth, the tall, white-haired warrior who becomes the game's antagonist. It's the story of how he became an antagonist, that Cloud used to know him in the past. And it includes the iconic moment where Sephiroth walks through flames. It was very good stuff. And Rebirth has a whole bunch of immediately noticeable differences, for better and for worse, I will say, from Remake, and especially from Intermission. To start with the good, they've upgraded the combat. It has more going on now. The synergies that I talked about have been carried over from Intermission and woven into the skill trees of your various characters. So you can do tag team special moves now. It makes the party members feel more involved in combat in a really cool way. And they often add a bit of cinematic flair. Some of them are really, really cool characters, like catapulting each other towards the enemy and that sort of thing. The traversal has also been improved. Cloud can now mantle over obstacles. This is something that I think I started to notice around the Horizon. No, it wasn't Horizon. It was Assassin's Creed Odyssey, sorry. When suddenly, when you're running towards a knee-high obstacle, it was an old problem that had been around for a long time that your character would just run against them. They couldn't, like, put a foot up, even if it looks like they physically could. But Assassin's Creed Odyssey was the first game I played where the protagonist just seemed to skip over things that were in the way. And it really, really improved open-world traversal for me. That has been included here in a manner. Cloud will now scale things if you hold down a certain button. And he will vault over stuff just of his own accord. But it's kind of janky here, like adorably janky. Sometimes Cloud will glitch up something that's 6 meters high and looks very improbable. Other times he will get stuck against a tiny rock or something like that. So it's not well done here, but I am glad that it's here. It does help to ameliorate the invisible wall problem that kind of plagued the first game, I would say. There is a crafting system now as well. So because it's an open world, you need things to do in it, of course. So they've put resources everywhere that give you excuses to go and explore the world. If you see a windmill, if you see a forest, if you see a ruined town, there's probably something there to pick up. You can use all of that to make your own potions. So they've definitely internalized some of those open world standards, things that we've gotten used to. But there is some less good stuff too. And I think the big one for me is that Rebirth has taken a really surprising visual hit. It is a huge downgrade from Intermission, and I would say it kind of looks worse than Remake, which is, of course, a four-year-old cross-gen game. So what is it about it that I don't like? Well, there's two graphics modes. It starts in a default performance mode, which is a lovely 60 frames a second, very smooth, very nice, but at the cost of resolution. And this is really noticeable. It's so blurry to look at to a constantly noticeable degree. Like, all of the beautiful detail in this world is kind of stripped out. Characters look smudgy, edges look smudgy, and that affects like the sense of depth perception that you have. It affects how interested you are in the world around you if you can see half of it. It kind of reminded me of docked Switch resolution sometimes, which is kind of crazy because that is, of course, 720 through to 1080p. I will say that I'm watching on a 4K TV that I have pulled up really close to my sofa. I have a little gaming goblin cave where I play on my PS5, and so I am probably seeing the worst of it. Like, the screen is very close to me, but it's been very, very distracting, constantly noticeable. There is also a graphics mode. I tried switching to that. It solves the resolution problem, but the frame rate is 30 without motion blur, which looks jarringly choppy. It made me feel a little seasick, so I abandoned that mode very quickly. And despite the fact that I am increasingly interested in fidelity as I get more into games, as I play more of them, but I would still maintain that I'm not like a fidelity snob. I mean, I played Starfield, that's 30fps, but it was beautiful 4K. It had lovely motion blur. It didn't feel jerky or jarring. And for some reason, the implementation here does. I would say that these two modes are either ends of a spectrum, and there is somewhere in the middle a Goldilocks zone that is just not available. There are no further settings, which I think is a real shame, because this game is beautiful in terms of the art. The town of Calm was gorgeous. I went back and looked at the original town from the original game. It's like a top-down tableau that you run around, and here you can explore it. It's come to life. There is a marketplace. There are people everywhere having dance classes, talking to each other, waiting for a date. They've all got bits of ambient dialogue. It feels very lively. Really, really, really fun. But it looks like ass, which is a bit of a problem for your experience of the game, if you ask me. It's quite strange looking and not at all easy on the eye. But I won't harp on that any longer. Let's hope for a patch. There were a couple of gameplay bits that did my head in too whilst we're on the bad stuff. The game grabs camera control from the player a lot, which always pulls me out of a moment, especially in an open world game. You want to feel free. You want to feel in control and to be allowed to just pass through the screen and lose yourself in it. When the game grabs the camera control, makes you look at something, I found that a bit jarring as well. And there's a lot of those slow walking sections, like a lot of them, where Cloud is limping or crawling or squeezing through a gap or getting through a duct. And they really slowed the game down a lot and made it feel a bit bitty to me. People say that that stuff gets better once you're out in the open world, and I am now. So let's see how it goes. Just to reiterate some of that good stuff, because I don't want to be like harping and negative, there is a lot to like here. Seeing old locations like Niflheim and Calm worked up to this scale was thrilling. The story is great, of course. The nostalgia is present and correct, and the game is suffused with that FF7 nostalgia. The group feels really good as they're starting to connect with each other. I'm glad that I have Red in my party now, and the combat is even better than before, so I am enjoying it, but I'm also a little bemused by it. I will report back later on my further progress with Final Fantasy Rebirth. The next game that I have for you is a little indie game called Summer House. This is a relaxing cabin builder by a solo dev called Friedemann. It's a very nice looking game. The house is very charming, has a very charming looking art style. And you start by choosing one of four empty landscapes, a grassy wilderness, mountain, a desert, or the outskirts of a city. Looks like Seattle or somewhere like that. There is a foundation for you to build on usually, or you can scroll around the scene from left to right just a little and pick the perfect place to start. You pick tiles from a menu on the left, and you lay them out in the world. You can move them in or out a little bit, you can position them, and you can choose the style of your cabin, whether you want it to be small and wooden, whether you want it to be a big stone house, whether you want it to be a tumble-down shed with a tin roof. All of those pieces are there for you, and there are quite a few. I have seen some footage of people that made very big, impressive houses. I always made little tumble-down shacks. Something about that kind of spoke to me. I liked using the crumbling material. You can add texture to the walls and things like that. TV aerials and satellite dishes. And in fact, that was my favourite part, was once you've got the basic structure of your cabin in place and put the roof on and everything, you can start adding details, like stringing up a clothesline to a lamppost or a tree with the drying clothes billowing in the breeze. You can add details like mailboxes, flags, pipes, aircon units, graffiti, a balcony, that kind of stuff, or a little seating area where the inhabitant of this cabin will sit and look at the view. So you can personalize it and give it a lot of character. I guess you could go ham on this and spend hours in there. I spent about 15 minutes building each of my summer houses and had fun doing it. But once you are finished building your summer houses in this game, there are four chances to do it. It's not scored or anything. There aren't any challenge modes. So that's kind of it. It's got a little bit of a digital toy kind of feel to it. And after seeing the trailer for this game and playing the demo at NextFest, I was looking forward to the gamification element of it, like how Summer House applies that it is a game to the task and the little cabin editor that it has built. I was hoping that there would be some kind of progression, because in the trailer, we could see new tiles popping, like you got a new roof, you got a new window, and I was like, oh great, so you'll be able to fill out like a big codex and get all of these cool bits. And I was thinking there might be challenge modes, like if you got a random pull, like a card that says, I want a house with a pointy roof, three flags, and a leafy area, or something like that. So you've got something to work towards that you then get a reward for. And if there was like, you know, 50 challenges or something, I think I would have really gotten stuck into this one, actually. But there's nothing like that in the game, really. And so when you're finished building your house, you just kind of stop, and there's no completion, there's no closure, and then you just move on to the next area. There are four, and they take about, as I said, 15, 20 minutes each, so there's an hour of gameplay here. And it is a small game, as Friedemann says in the title card of the game. It's a tiny game by Friedemann. So I get that this is scoped the way it is scoped, and this is the vision for it. But after an hour, I felt like I was done with it. It is, I should also say, $5, or I think $4 right now. So it's a cheap little game, and it's fun to play for the time that you have with it. But I can't help thinking that it could have been a little more. I think there are two types of games in this ambient builder kind of game. There is stuff like Townscaper, that one where you just you build little houses and they sort of naturally congeal into a cool town that you can make more vertical or grow outwards. It's an infinite builder with no goals to it at all, and it's mellow, fun for an hour, and then over. And then there's the other kind of game that applies a little more game structure to this format. I think of games like Dorf Romantik, where you are rewarded for matching tile edges and building outwards, and you get more tiles based on how well you are doing. So there is a puzzle element to it that kept me playing for tens of hours. I also think about Cloud Gardens, a game where you have an endless creative mode to build anything that you can imagine. But it also has a campaign, so a level structure, where you have to complete certain tasks to get onto the next scene. So there's a game structure there, and that kept me playing for tens of hours as well. In fact, I played that game twice because I found it so relaxing. If you haven't played Dorf Romantik or Cloud Gardens, they are both wonderful games. So I am curious if Summer House will be the start of something. Friedemann tweeted out that it sold 70,000 copies or something like that, which I think he was very happy about. So it'd be really fun to see if this game is built upon, and if more is added to it over time. I would definitely come back to it if there was more to do. But if that sounds fun to you, then certainly check it out. I had a good time with it for an hour. That's Summer House. And I have one more game to talk about this episode. It is Geometry Survivor by Brain Seal. And this is a game that dares to ask the question, what if you took Vampire Survivors and made it more Tron? So that tells you a lot of what you need to know about this one. I only played this one for half an hour or so. It didn't quite click with me. It is one of the flood of Vampire Survivors likes that people are calling Bullet Heavens, which I absolutely love. It's not often that we see a whole new genre being born. And I remember that people were kicking around various options for naming it, like Vampire Survivors like wasn't quite working. So it ended up being Bullet Heaven. That's the one that caught on. And I think it was the right one. Lots of games came in the wake of Vampire Survivors. This one is another in that trend. Instead of the crunchy asset store fantasy art that we had in Vampire Survivors. This one is a very slick-looking game. Instead, we get neon, geometric, Tron-like space invaders that spawn all around us. We are just a little hexagon with a ring around it for each shield. You can get hit 3 times. It looks great. It really does have a very sleek Tempest 2000 kind of look to it, but it's been dressed up a little. There are lots of flashy explosions and cool light effects. It's set against the void of space, so it doesn't have that sense of place that Vampire Survivors managed to muster, even if it was a jumble of stuff. There was still like a library and a field area and a castle. None of that here, but the gameplay is the same. You have to dodge enemies by moving around. Firing happens automatically on a cooldown. You start with just a simple one shot. You explode enemies. You move around. You try not to die. Enemies drop little pips that you then pick up, and every now and then it pops, and you get to choose one of 3 power-ups. These vary from heat-seeking missiles to a ship that moves around you to lasers that will flare from you and take out groups of enemies to black holes that will suck enemies in now and then, all of that kind of stuff. So you do power up, you feel your power ramping in that Vampire Survivors style. And I think that this sounds good in theory, and they've done a great job with the visuals and the pumping electronic music. But as for the gameplay experience, it felt a little bit hollow to me, and I've been trying to put my finger on why. It was missing some of that juice that Vampire Survivor has. You know, in Vampire Survivors, the developer famously worked on gambling stuff before making that game, and so it had this fruit machine element to it. All of the picking up of power-ups was very satisfying. The screen kind of popped, you got fun music and effects on screen, and it felt like progress. The rewards here didn't feel quite as satisfying. You get like quite a cold, text-heavy boxes. You get 3 boxes to choose from. And when you get them, the rewards didn't feel as immediately impactful as they did in Vampire Survivors. I think in Vampire Survivors, the first time you get your first garlic or something that shoots in the direction that you're walking, it changes how you play the game. That didn't quite happen here. So instead of that very clear, visible, tangible leveling up, it felt less meaningful here. And so that instant satisfaction of destroying stuff and getting stronger didn't quite happen. It didn't quite click. And I think that was the core appeal of Vampire Survivors, really. It was this endless ramping up of your own endless destructive potential until the screen is just awash and you've created something kind of crazy. So it's very interesting to me that you can take such a simple concept as the Vampire Survivors bullet heaven concept and make a much better looking, more modern feeling adaptation with glossier graphics and slick music, and end up with something that kind of lacks the magic of the original. And it made me think of Vampire Survivors slightly differently. It's a very lo-fi game, but I think it is deceptively simple because of the look of it and the simplicity of the gameplay. And in actual fact, a lot of tiny choices were made right, and that's what made that game hit the way it did. It is perfectly addictive, perfectly satisfying, very easily readable, very easy to grasp. And so you just go straight into it and you just don't stop for hours. It's a very addictive game, as I'm sure a lot of you know. That didn't quite happen with Geometry Survivors. So it's an interesting case study and an interesting game to have tried alongside something like Vampire Survivors. But I think after half an hour, I was like, I'd rather be playing the other game. I guess that's an occupational hazard when making something that is a direct clone. But I thought it made for an interesting conversation anyway. That's the last game I had for you today, and that was Geometry Survivor. So that's our episode. I hope you enjoyed it. It's fun to talk about Final Fantasy VII. I actually did tweet about the slow walking thing yesterday. I went back on Twitter this morning and it's up to like 100 replies and 400 likes and all of these retweets. I've had to set the replies to people who follow me only because there was a lot of Final Fantasy stands being quite angry with me. Oops. But I am enjoying that game despite what I said about it. I'm hoping for that patch. and I will report back on that one. We also talked about Summer House, a lovely little game, and then we rounded it out with Geometry Survivor. Thanks very much, as always, for listening. You can find me online and tell me what you're playing, recommend a game that you'd like to hear about on this show. You can find me anywhere as Gaming in the Wild, on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, where I'm very active currently. You're also welcome to come and join the Patreon, to join our Discord community, and get bonus episodes about music, about travel, about all kinds of things. So thanks for listening. I'll be back next week with another episode. Hopefully I will get through Snufkin and give you a full review of that game, because it's a really, really nice one. And in the meantime, take care of yourselves and each other, and bye-bye for now.